NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. We are recording this show on the heels of the NTSB's three-day hearing regarding the mid-air collision over the Potomac River back on January 29th. And I will hold a lot of comments, but it was very informative. There were a number of subject areas that had a lot of my interest, because a lot of the things that they talked about are issues that I have to address in my current work. John, I know that you were just intently glued for 3 days. You locked yourself in your house with bags of potato chips and Diet Coke because you were just so enthralled by all of the information. And Todd, well, you just got it through osmosis. But the big thing is that there was a lot of information. The board. And again, we can talk about it a little bit. Sometimes it gets a little too scripted, which then it causes those of us who've been down that path and in that role, a little bit of pain, because you script a question, they answer it, and then you move to the next question without following up. Fortunately, the board members were plugged in. They did follow up on a number of those scripted questions and answers. And I think Todd Inman did a really good job of, you know, following up on questions that had been asked. He got right to the bottom line, and put people on the spot looking for answers. But John, I know that, you know, you watched it all. What were your impressions?
On the board member performance, I would say that Inman was number one and the chairman was a close second.
Yeah.
They both push hard. Graham was the weak sister in the whole group. You know, Inman repeatedly wouldn't accept a fluff answer.
Yeah.
He kept pushing back on them. So he dug out a lot of facts, made them commit to a lot of facts, and got angry with them a few times. And the chairman got angry, very angry, over the disclosure, a lack of disclosing documents that they asked for. You know, the NTSB made a big point of, on Friday, the FAA dumped a huge quantity of documents on the NTSB, many of which didn't answer to the questions that the NTSB had submitted months ago for them to answer. So,
when I was doing Go Team stuff and putting hearings together and following up, I mean, that's the role of the IIC, is to make sure that the group chairman who've requested information are pinging, whether it's the FAA, the airline, the union, doesn't matter, pinging them on a regular basis to ensure that you don't have what happened in this particular hearing, and that is get a dump on Friday afternoon before the start of a hearing. Hopefully those procedures will, I don't know what broke down, whether that was on the NTSB side or the FAA, but we always pinged the FAA on a regular basis to provide the data so we had time to analyze it and ferret out what was necessary for the purposes of the public hearing.
You know, and the FAA did disclose that on a number of the data from the measured the tower's performance and the near misses at the tower and all the problems, the FAA every year or so was bouncing it through different programs. So it was always disconnected since before, back, I think it went back to 19, but clearly went back to 22, where they were bouncing this program between different computer programs to do the analysis. And they never got a handle on it. And I kind of think that may have been by design.
Yeah, Todd, I mean, you're the stats guy. You're the, you know, dig deep into the data. What are your impressions?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of data in this particular hearing and in the docket. For example, I was looking at the docket this morning. It's like 203 items there. This is even before the hearing happened. So for those of you who are looking for data about this, there's plenty of data. Will it be stuff that will answer your questions? That's a whole different question. For example, one of the things I thought was unique was they had a transcript of the conversations that happened in the aircraft, which is not unusual. But in this case, they had one that had side by side the helicopter, the airliner, and air traffic control, including details that weren't even in the hearing. And also they provided several videos of what looks like security cameras in and around the airport. So you can see some of the flight of the aircraft and helicopter. And for those of you watching the video, there's a close-up of the moments right before impact, which is confirming some of the information that came out in the investigation, such as about where on the aircraft the helicopter hit it, whether or not the airliner was doing some sort of evasive maneuver just before impact, which it was. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is there's a lot of stuff there. If you have a specific set of questions or specific interests, then burrow down and find that. But trying to take this, you know, all at once and make sense out of it, you can make a PhD dissertation out of this and not get to halfway to the bottom of it.
Yeah, and one of the things that always happens with public hearings is that there is an abundance of information, much of which never sees the light of day in the report. Some of the information is used for supporting recommendations, either reiteration of previous recommendations or the creation of new recommendations. But, you know, when you have a 3-day hearing, John and I, when I did ValueJet, we had a 5-day hearing. We had a lot of information. You can only put so much in a report and, of course, use the other stuff for recommendations. But it's good historical research. I'm going to be using quite a bit of this stuff. There was a doctor, not at the NTSB, it was one of the witnesses on a panel, who was very good at talking about spatial disorientation, vertigo, and visual acuity. And especially, you know, whether you're using NVGs or not. I mean, I use that kind of information in the work that I currently do now. So that'll really help me. And then John brought up, I kind of missed it, but I've gone back to look at it, that there's a lot of good information about ADS-B because of its limitations. You do have to understand how the calculations are made. And I've run across issues with the NTSB and misinterpretation of ADS-B data. This testimony provided some clarity. I know how to calculate it because I've researched it and talked to folks that actually have programmed it and dealt with it on a regular basis. But this provided clarity. And then there is, you know, a lot of focus, especially in the beginning, John, with regard to Army procedures and training, not across the board from an Army op standpoint, but really focused on the D.C. metro area and the proximity to Washington National and all of the special operation flights that take place by the Army in that particular segment of airspace.
And just let me, for a moment, just give you an idea of just how much information is there that you alluded to. I'm just reading off some of the things in the public docket. Helicopter operations interview transcripts, 1,098 pages. We have individual training and proficiency records, which looks like a military one again. Excuse me, for ATC, not military, 861 pages. DCA Air Traffic Control Tower facility logs and records, 1,384 pages. So again, if you have issues, if you have questions, if you're trying to get to the bottom of the mystery, and you're just using the public docket, get a cup of coffee, get your questions in your head.
Get a cup of coffee. You might want to get a thermos and sit there for a week. You're not going to rifle through that in a day.
Now, I hate to mention what's inevitably going to happen, but eventually there will be legal proceedings against who, we don't know. But at the very least, any legal organization that's trying to make a case one way or the other has some raw data here, and they'll probably ask for and get a whole lot more beyond this. So if you think this is a lot of data for an aircraft accident, you two have been involved in several litigations when it comes to aircraft accidents. There can be a lot more documentation than this in aircraft accidents that are smaller than this.
Yeah, when you're talking 10, 15, maybe even 20,000 documents, that's one thing. But, you know, the litigation in this is going to be quite simple, I think, because, you know, there were a lot of statements made by high-ranking government officials in the immediate aftermath of this particular event. One, apologizing, but two, taking responsibility for who caused the accident. And the finger was immediately pointed at the military crew. Now, the FAA, the NTSB went after the FAA very hard in the three-day hearing. And John, you know, some of it was warranted because you and I, when we were at the board, especially me, having spent over 20 years there, I wrote a number of recommendations as part of not only major investigations, but even general aviation accidents, where it's, you know, the response was, thanks for your interest in aviation safety, but pound sand, we got other things to do. And or they said that they didn't have the resources, the capabilities, the equipment and things like that. And then on top of it, you and I have had this discussion offline about the politics that's involved. It's one thing to earmark a lot of money to the FAA to try to accomplish their mission. But then when the spotlight is off, you know, other programs seem to rob the FAA and the airport improvement program of funds to fund other programs. And next thing you know, there's a shortfall. There's a lack of resources, both monetary and personnel. And then we get right back into this same groove. And the FAA takes the brunt of, you didn't do anything over the last 30 plus years.
The tracks led from the, in this case, from the tower through management, through to DC, and then to Congress for the resources. So they all have dirty hands in this process. The controllers, it was pretty evident, the controllers at this facility and others have been reaching out and crying for help with the system because it's become so busy, and their cries and pleas have gone unresponded to. The management, now, how often do you get the workforce and management to agree on problems? And the management was going to their higher-ups looking for similar relief from these problems. And that upper level took it to Washington. And, you know, now I understand. If the management at the facility doesn't have the money, they can't make any changes. Right? When you bring it to Washington, if that office doesn't have the money, what are they going to do, right? And you hit the nail on the head, Greg. The money, sometimes the resources are siphoned off for other programs that got in trouble. We saw it with the accident in Charlotte that you and I were on over the Doppler radar. Yep. And as soon as the NTSB started to nail the FAA on the installation of the Doppler radar, they suddenly diverted money from other programs and implemented a whole bunch of stations with Doppler radar. Yeah. So that was a perfect example of putting the fire out that came from the crash in Charlotte, but they stole the money from other programs. So those other programs are now going to languish.
Yeah.
And yeah, and what Charlotte event are you two referring to?
U.S. Air 1016, back in 1994, July 2nd. You know, and things like that. I mean, the NTSB was very pointed. They had a lot of management. Now, there's a couple things. Some of those management folks that testified today haven't been in position very long. And that was part of their excuse was, hey, I've only been there a month. I really am not up to speed. I don't have access. They tried to at least preside or at least present a perspective of, okay, here's the hierarchy that even me as a manager has to go through. But I think that, you know, this is not just one administration. We've seen this through multiple administrations. And the biggest problem that I think, and I didn't hear it addressed, was the fact that there's been a lack of consistency within the FAA as far as upper management. I'm talking administrator, deputy administrator for almost 15 years. We've gone, it's a revolving door over there. And when you have five administrators in a very short period of time, they're not going to take any action. They're not going to take a stand. And then they walk out the door after their 2-year stint or 3-year stint rather than stay in their term, or they get bumped out. Next thing you know, you got the folks right below them going, I'm not going to do anything. I want to keep my job. We don't know whose agenda we're going to have to follow. And nobody takes any action. And like right now, did they talk about, John, how many vacancies the FAA has below the administrator position or actings that are in the in those positions? At one time, the administrator and four positions below it were all either empty or filled with actings.
All right, so they alluded to it, but they didn't focus on the individuals. And for the folks out there, acting, any person in government that moves in as an actor takes no initiative to bring on new programs. That person is essentially a placeholder, right? So they never implement other programs, new programs. That they leave that to the incoming person to decide what direction they want to set their department. So even though there's an actor in those jobs, it's really a caretaker's position, and nothing gets done that is a new initiative in any way.
So and we've identified that. I mean, again, the NTSB has written recommendation after recommendation. I wouldn't be surprised when you read the NTSB report on this particular accident, when you go to the recommendation section, it's going to say that, you know, this recommendation is reiterated for the second time. This recommendation is reiterated for the fourth time. This recommendation, because been down that road. We've made these recommendations. We've talked about resources. We've talked about equipment. We've talked about all of this stuff historically. And I think the NTSB, you know, got on their high horse with the FAA. But again, the people that we're talking to aren't in the position of allocating the dollars. I'm hoping that now with Brian Bedford there as the administrator, having access to $12.5 billion, you know, that Secretary Duffy has allotted to the FAA, that money stays within the FAA, earmarked for all the things that they say that money is being used for. And that, again, all of these things, yeah, a lot of the changes that were discussed by the Army have already been implemented, which is great because that's the purpose of accident investigation, is to ferret out all of these discrepancies or deficiencies in the system, whether it's with an organization or an individual, and correct them in real time. And it sounds like the Army has implemented a lot of this. I know the FAA has said that they started to implement some of these things. But again, what I don't think was explained very well is that you can't just stroke the pen in the United States government and either create a regulation or change a policy overnight. It's not that easy.
Let me add that little context to what you've been saying for the last minute or two. You mentioned Secretary Duffy. That's Secretary Sean Duffy, who is the head of the Department of Transportation. The FAA is within the Department of Transportation. the Department of the Army is within the Department of Defense, a different kettle of fish entirely. Then you have the NTSB, which is an independent agency. And like you said, you just can't write one law and have everything happen at once. You have there three different large organizations and one subordinate organization, all trying to figure out how to work the airspace, how to make it safer. It's not an easy thing.
The FAA commented on one procedure they were trying to change. They've been at it for 3 months or 4 months already. They expected that it's going to take another 3 months to get it to the, not to the final, to the finish line, but get it to a point where it goes out for public comment and then you start the process for rulemaking. They won't see that change until sometime next year.
Yeah, and it's not like the president stroking a pen on an executive order. The FAA can't do that. Rulemaking, and again, it's a very complex process to an extent because the FAA, part of their rulemaking, they have to look at the economic impact of changing rules and regulations and that kind of stuff. It's all part of a very prescribed process. And unless you've been intimately involved in it and walked it through, things can't happen tomorrow. And that's just the nature. And even if they were given the authority, if the FAA administrator is given the authority to change a regulation tomorrow, that could create not only a firestorm amongst operators and users of the national airspace system, but of course, you could create more problems by just implementing something that sounds good, feels good, but hasn't been well thought out. And so, again, while the hearings are great, they bring out the deficiencies. And I know the chairman had made this statement multiple times telling the FAA they should do better. Okay, what's doing better? Well, okay, maybe you streamline the timeline of trying to implement this stuff. But there is a prescribed procedure. There is only so much money and there's only so much manpower right now. So, I mean, it's like, okay, great. You can't put 5,000 air traffic controllers in facilities because we don't have a pool of 5,000 air traffic controllers. The public has to keep things in context, and so do not only the regulators, but the NTSB when they put forth these recommendations, because there is a time element, a timeline that goes with any kind of change.
Let me ask something that two of you had experience with, that is dealing with the NTSB when it went through a very large multi-day public hearing about a major event. Now, obviously, we've all seen what happened this week, but the two of you have been directly involved in several in the past. And are they each unique, or is there something that there's a line that goes through all of these with respect to how outsiders and even insiders should look at this particular part of the process and how useful it is to increase safety?
You want to start that, John, or do you want me?
I'll start with usefulness. One of the things that the NTSB has done very well over time is to use the press as a vehicle to drive change. So a good story given to a reporter, accurate, factual, can drive people in the FAA and other pieces of the government and even Congress to take action. So as long as the press has accurate information, because we have an industry that if they find material inaccuracies in whatever you're presenting, they'll discount it. And a good example is Mary Schiavo's book, where the publisher made a number of mistakes in some of the chapters with dates, facts and figures, essentially. And when that came out, the industry picked it apart, nitpicked it to the point where they said the book is useless. And that wasn't the case. The issues were there, but because of the rush to publish, they had some problems, and it was a shame.
And so Mary Schiavo, just for the audience, she was a former FAA attorney. I can't remember her particular office. What was her role in the FAA?
She was actually the DOTIG.
So Inspector General. So her office evaluated all the agencies under the Department of Transportation. So nobody in the government liked her office because essentially she would kiss and tell. she would come in and look at what you're doing and then file a report saying how messed up you were.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
You know, there's a lot of confusion out there around the FAA requirements. Most people don't realize that the FAA requirements are the minimum standard.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not the best. It's just the minimum.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to see. We don't necessarily say you have to do X, Y, and Z. We just want you to do more than the minimum required of you. Because obviously, the more you do, the better pilot you will be.
Great. And then, how are you received when you try to encourage pilots to go that extra step or go above and beyond? Are they resistant to it? Do they say, well, you know, I get enough training or I do enough flying, I don't need to do that?
Honestly, the majority of the pilots that we deal with are willing to go that extra mile. Or when we tell them their discounts are available, they're already doing.
And if I choose to do that additional training, what do I have to provide to you so that I get credit for that?
You have to just let us know. You give us a call, tell us what you're doing, we'll document it, and we don't need any documentation sent to us.
Great.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
I think the other thing that's important for the public to know, and again, unless you watched the hearing and heard the opening statement by the chairman or were intimately involved, is that the NTSB is a non-regulatory agency. They have no regulatory oversight. They have no regulatory authority. And so when I've seen people on the internet light it up going, the NTSB should be able to, create regulations. No, because then that would negate the objectivity that the board brings into these investigations, whether it's aviation, marine, pipeline, doesn't matter. You have to have that objectivity and that neutrality, because as it was reiterated multiple times over the last 3 days, especially when it was perceived by the board members that people weren't forthcoming with information. There was an incident that apparently happened on the Thursday, the second day of the hearing, where an FAA person was supposedly answering a question and got, quote, nudged by another FAA person sitting next to him, basically telling him to shut up. And the chairman, or I should say the chairwoman, ended up addressing that, like, what's going on here? This is a transparent hearing. This is a safe haven or a safe place to speak out. And they were looking for, honest answers. The problem is it's human nature to be forthcoming and be critical of the agency that employs you and gives you a paycheck. That's very difficult, whether it's an airline or the United States government. It's very hard to say, well, yeah, we suck. or a particular individual has, put up barriers so we can't get anything done because people are fearful of their respective positions. And so that does hamper it a little bit. And that's why the board has to maintain that neutrality, because if they don't get it in this public forum, they may get the information that they need in other ways through individual interviews and things like that. So again, for the public watching this and reading just the highlights or watching them on TV on the nightly news, yeah, you're getting the good stuff, if you will, to a point. But there was a lot of good stuff that folks like myself and you, Todd and John, I mean, we use that in our everyday work to enhance aviation safety in one form or fashion.
Let me go back to what John said a few minutes ago about how hearings like this have been useful for the NTSB to get the media to sort of use it as leverage. You've been around for things like the ValueJet investigation and the public hearings and Flight 800, and I believe also the rudder reversal issues with the 737 back in the 1990s. The difference between then and now is that we have all this other media, not the mainstream media, but social media, including what we're doing here right now. How has this made things, in your opinions, more difficult or less difficult with respect to improving safety?
I would say it's less. It's not as, it doesn't have the legs. It doesn't have the focus. When you run a story on the front page of the Washington Post that every management person in Washington reads, and you run that repeatedly, identifying the problems, the flaws, the roadblocks in the system, it gets action. How many congressmen, how many business leaders do we have sitting on their computer looking at this program or YouTube or whatever other program they look at? Not many, but they read that paper going to work in the morning. Because Washington, a huge percentage of the people that work in Washington take public transportation or the train. So they're not focused on the road. They have the opportunity to read what's going on.
Yeah. The only other problem with that is some of the good stuff gets diluted, misinterpreted, or twisted so that people who we've been critical of, the internet trolls and the junior investigators, don't interpret it the way it needs to be interpreted or leave it in context, and then make a whole different factoid storyline out of it that really misses the point. We've been there. We've done that. We've been through the process. There is some good information. It's already led the change even before the final report, but there is further change to come. But we've had this discussion off air. And the question is, okay, after this hearing, since it's over, what's the follow-up? Who's gonna watchdog this? The NTSB will produce a report, you know, probably in another year. They'll have the Sunshine meeting. They'll come up with all the facts they put in the report. They'll talk about the recommendations and a determination of probable cause. Then what? We've seen this where we've made these recommendations after recommendations after recommendations for the last 30 years. And after the spotlight's off, you know, the board receives a response, whether it's from the FAA or the Army or an airline or whatever, saying this is the action we're going to take. Well, then that recommendation either gets closed, acceptable action, or remains open or whatever. And then it goes on and on and on into the abyss. And then next thing you know, we have another similar accident and they have to reiterate the same recommendation over and over and over again. It is sometimes a very frustrating process.
You know what's missing, Greg? In our day, we had the likes of Bob Orr, Hager, Lisa Stark, reporters on the Washington beat that understood the accidents, yeah, the accident investigation, like the back of their hand.
Yep.
And they could articulate in their respective publications exactly what was going on. They could do their own analysis, and it was damn good, and drive it on. They are all retired, and they haven't been replaced. Right? There's just nobody with that experience. And I know both of us, we get called all the time, and sometimes you have to do the basic explaining before you can do the explaining on the issue, because the reporter on the other end of the phone is just naive.
Yeah.
So we've lost a lot with that high quality of reporting that we had from both the TV and the pencil press. You know, Don Phillips from the Washington Post and
Matt Wald and all these guys,
the New York Times. I mean, they wrote very pointed articles, accurate and hard hitting articles. That helped drive change.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that through this hearing, like I said, the general public, the flying public, and even the industry can't expect anything to change tomorrow. You'll see subtle changes. You'll see possibly some action starting to take place. But like the FAA said, and you just mentioned it, John, they've got equipment in a facility. One of the FAA folks said, we've got this equipment in the Potomac TradeCon. It's been sitting there for 7 years. And of course, just that statement alone, it's like, what do you mean 7 years? Why haven't you done anything with it? But then the context, the follow-up to that was, not only do we have to train the folks where this piece of equipment is, but we have 9 other facilities that feed into the Washington, D.C. airspace. So now we have to go out, put equipment in those 9 facilities, train all of the people in those 9 facilities. That does not happen overnight. And, you know, it's a very well-choreographed dance that takes a very long time. You can't just put a piece of equipment in there and, you know, flip the switch and expect that everybody's going to be able to operate it, or that piece of equipment is actually going to enhance airspace operations, because it is a very complex system and it takes a lot of coordination. And I don't know how much of that was emphasized. It was discussed, and guys like us, we can capture that and understand it. But to the lay public, it's like, it's just airspace, you know, just tell them to do this and tell, you can't do that. It doesn't work that way.
I'm glad you mentioned choreography of air traffic control, because the two of you have a unique perspective. As we talked off air, John, you had an office that actually looked out on National Airport and the traffic going in and out. And you, Greg, you actually flew your plane down the Potomac once as a pilot. And you've both been in and out of that airport dozens, if not hundreds of times over the years. So you've probably seen a lot of the elements that went into this accident in front of your eyes every day. And John, you remarked how it was sort of amazing that, they got this all done. So given what happened with the accident, given what happened in this hearing, given your own personal experience, what surprises you or doesn't surprise you about what you probably saw for years manifesting itself in the ultimate nightmare and the response to that nightmare?
Well, one of the things that I'm surprised with the hearing is how forceful both the chairwoman and member Engman were. They really had done their piece of homework, and they were not taking defend, defect, and deny answers from the FAA or the Army. As soon as they started to go down that road, you know, the somebody else's job, they jumped all over them. So that's a real plus. Not embarrassed, but you focus it on that individual that's not being totally honest in answering the questions. So it makes people uncomfortable, and sometimes when they're uncomfortable, they will go do the right thing. That's a hope on my part.
It's going to be interesting to see, the folks that testified on behalf of the Army, they were very articulate. I was impressed, but it shouldn't be impressive, because they do that every day. They're very structured, very systematic. They were able to articulate. The thing that's going to be interesting is to see, because they can't implement things necessarily at a local level. It's got to go to a higher level. And of course, it's got to go through the Secretary of Defense if it's some sort of major change and things like that. Again, it is a timelined process, but it will be one of those things where the media has got to continue to hawk these issues that came up, at least for the next 6 months, just to see, okay, did we make it through this hearing? Yeah. Did we, you know, get beat up? Are we licking our wounds? And you know what? Nobody's watching anymore, so we don't really have to put a priority to it. That's always been the case after these public hearings that we ran, John, with the exception. I mean, look, when we did Value Jet, we were talking, I mean, we identified it. We discussed it ad nauseum with experts about smoke detection and fire suppression on commercial aircraft, commercial airliners. And there was a rush. We're going to put all this equipment on. Then what happened, John?
And they put the rule out. New airplanes were manufactured with that equipment on it. So we stopped the problem from growing. And then they got exemptions for the existing airplanes that went on for another 10 or 12 years, at which point those airplanes were all retired and there was no need to upgrade the systems on the airplanes.
Yeah, because nobody wanted to spend that kind of money.
Right.
So, yeah, it is a vicious cycle sometimes. There is a lot of change that needs to be made. And I think that when you apportion, you know, and again, people are going, oh, it's a blame game and everything else. No, what we're trying to do through acts investigation is identify those deficiencies, target the appropriate organizations that can affect change to either significantly reduce, mitigate, or eliminate these risks from, you know, proliferating, or at least showing up in some other venue where we could have a similar type accident. And again, it was, I think, a very fruitful hearing. There's a lot of information. Now, here's my pet peeve. While all of the focus has been on this last 3 days of public hearing and things seem to be centered on Washington, D.C. in this midair, my real problem is, what was the last thing you all heard about the Learjet that crashed in Philadelphia? What was the last thing you heard about the 10 fatal accident up in Alaska? What was the last thing you heard about the Learjet that crashed in Arizona? What was the last? We've had almost 25 to 30 pilots and passengers killed in accidents in the past 6 months, besides the Washington, D.C. accident. And the sad thing is, where's the focus on those? Because there are issues to be developed, deficiencies to be corrected, and families who are, you know, lost a loved one. Yet those have just gone off into the abyss. Where's the NTSB with that? I understand the resources it takes to run a public hearing because I've had to do it multiple times. But there are investigators who still have a responsibility to work on those respective accidents and, you know, identify the issues, make the change, write the recommendations to affect the change, and get those investigations completed and at least put out something. I mean, they've all gone quiet.
Yep. Well, the chairwoman did mention Alaska in chiding the FAA because I guess they're stonewalling that investigation as well.
You got 10 fatalities just in that accident alone. And it's just, again, you can't stop the ship. There are other accidents that are being investigated. You got 6 fatal in a citation in San Diego. I mean, aviation doesn't stop. And unfortunately, we will continue to have serious incidents and accidents that need to be addressed because there are safety issues most likely that are going to develop out of those respective investigations. So again, we got to keep going with that. You can't just turn all your attention to the midair. Yeah, it's, you know, very unfortunate that we lost 67 people, but again, there are a lot of accidents that need to be addressed as well.
Well, I think that this is a good time for a special second to last word, especially because this was an unusual event for those who follow aviation and aviation safety. Very huge public hearing, very, very tragic accident, global media attention, and a whole lot of attention being focused on what went wrong and how things can go right. Something that happens on a regular basis in the United States. And as we speak, there's a major investigation going on in India where there are issues galore. Yet the likelihood that there will be some sort of public venue where the major entities involved have to speak up and take account for what they did or what they didn't do, potentially being embarrassing in front of millions of people. That's something that's not easy to do. It's not easy to set it up. It's not easy for organizations to honestly speak in something like this, but I think it's absolutely essential if you're going to move aviation forward in your particular part of the world. And that's not the only country I'd like to call out. We have other countries like China, mainland China, which has possibly the second biggest domestic aviation system for airliners in the world. Yet the amount of transparency is orders of magnitude less than what you would see here. You would barely see a public accident report, and you wouldn't see a public docket or anything like it. Brazil, which has an excellent organization that does aviation safety. However, it's a military organization. And can you imagine the kind of transparency you would have if one branch of the military, the Air Force in Brazil, is running the investigation, and another branch of the military in Brazil, let's say the Army, were involved. Would you have the level of honesty and forthrightness and really willingness to change as you have in this situation here? So what's my final message to the world? Look at this, make fun of it if you will, but learn from it. And if you can, implement changes in your own part of the world that can make aviation safety better.
And with that, John, we will leave you with our last word.
And I think I'm going to deviate from my normal last word. And I want to talk to the families out there that may or may not be listening to us. They came into this hearing hoping to get answers, and they weren't going to get answers by the way the hearing's structured, but they did get an awful lot of information. I think if they understand how to read what was put on the program and the data that was put out, and maybe go back in and pull some documents down, they can make their own determinations about where the majority of the problems with this accident lay, but they're going to have to wait for the NTSB to issue their final report with all the recommendations, conclusions and recommendations of where the real meat. You know, so, you know, on the surface, the probable cause will be something like the Army and the FAA failed to do whatever it was they're supposed to do. All right, so they'll identify it that way. But the real meat will be in the findings that lead up to the probable cause and the recommendations that go off to the Army and the FAA after the probable cause. So unfortunately, the families are going to have to wait a bit longer. But given how much information has been disclosed already, I can see a whole bunch of findings and a whole bunch of recommendations coming out of this. And given how hot two of the three board members were, I think they're going to be quite pointy, the recommendations.
I couldn't agree more. And our respects go out to the family of the victims of not only this tragic accident, but all the ones that we just previously mentioned. So with that, I will say, fly safe.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.